You're listening to episode 25 of the Mentoring Developers Podcast.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
Hi, everyone. Today, I'm really excited to bring you Edward Stull. Ed is a user experience designer and researcher, and he has managed teams. He's a great friend. I've learned a ton from him, including consulting and managing teams and a whole lot of stuff. And I think you will really enjoy and benefit from his experience and his unique take on things. He's on the user experience side of things, so he is not somebody who codes day in and day out, but I think it's very important for us to get the perspective of somebody who understands the user and can help us develop better applications. So I'm really looking forward to this interview. I want you to listen to it, and I want you to let us know how you think and give us some feedback. That would be amazing. I'd like to invite everybody out there, all the developers, designers, user experience people, aspiring developers, new developers, experienced developers, mentors, and mentees. I would love for you to be part of the show. I would love for you to be a panelist. I'd love for you to be a guest. If you have strong opinions, if you have well-considered opinions about mentorship, about software development, about starting out as a software engineer, about growing your career, any of these topics, if you have good opinions, solid opinions, and you'd like to share it with the world, come on as a guest, come on as a panelist. So if you're interested, go to mentoringdevelopers.com/join. mentoringdevelopers.com/join. Now here's my interview with Edward Stull. Today I have the pleasure of introducing you to a good friend of mine. He is a user experience guru. He has written a book and he's actively writing a book, and it's going to be in an audio format as well about user experience. And usually I ask my guests about themselves first, but I think I want to change it up a little bit. I want to ask him first about user experience, and then I will ask him to describe himself. What is this user experience, Ed?
Well, hi, Arsalan. Yeah, thank you very much for having me on your podcast, first off. User experience, it's a great question, and it challenges all of us to try to make an adequate explanation of it. But user experience as a whole is really just the result of using any product or service. That's actually user experience. Now, second to that is it often kind of combines with user experience design, and that's the professional application of trying to create effective user experiences. And that often kind of becomes a combination of taking what a user would want to do and what a business wants to do, and trying to find ways of reconciling that so you can have good user experiences resulting from that.
Great. So now that we have out of the way, so let me introduce you. Your name is Edward Stull. You are a consultant and you do user experience design. How do you describe yourself?
Well, you know, I think you just did a great job with it. I usually introduce myself. And what I generally tell people is I'm a user experience designer and researcher, because about half my work is the actual design, where I'm trying to essentially generate, sometimes it's documents. Often it's a matter of brainstorming, trying to help teams solve software as well as even digital marketing issues. And then the other half is research, which is primary and secondary research, which you might even have you might see in other roles. For instance, it's not maybe as robust as, say, for instance, a traditional academic role. But a lot of times I do usability research as well as accessibility research as well. And then also third-party research. So big time is, you know me, Arsalan, I'm kind of a big nerd. So I end up spending a lot of time going through research reports, going through a secondary and tertiary research sources to be able to kind of hopefully support any type of decision we're doing in terms of software with evidence.
And so you do this research in when you're working for a client as part of a billable work, as part of something you get, they're paying you to do this research. Or are you doing this research to just keep up to date?
No, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I would say at least the way I was defining it, the first way is to say that it tends into being a part of, you know, a paid engagement. Not all projects have research, and there's not necessarily, you know, always the case where you have to do a large primary research study. Sometimes it's just simply doing the due diligence of just kind of realizing what type of audience you're talking with, or say, for instance, a client's business, you know, the sector that they're operating in, that can just end up being research. And then I think the second part of your question, if I heard you correctly, is to say that there is just a lot of research as well, so to try to keep marketable and also realize what's kind of the state of the nation in terms of what's going on from a UX and information architecture perspective.
Besides user experience design and research, you've also dabbled in programming. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences in programming, what you have done so far? How did you get started with that?
Good question. Yeah, you know, I think I would completely unimpress your audience with my knowledge of programming, but it is something that I think it makes me a better user experience designer if I can end up understanding the way that a lot of things are built. And so my knowledge is primarily based on kind of scripting languages and then also things such as, you know, HTML, a lot of client-side work. A couple of years ago, I decided I wanted to kind of noodle around with building iPhone apps. So I learned kind of rudimentary level Objective-C, which for me was fascinating because it was a bit like opening up a big door that had been closed for a good part of my career, learning about, you know, all the kind of, you know, traditional parlance of developers in terms of arrays and structs and, you know, methods and classes and things like that. But that type of structured thinking has really helped me understand, you know, system-based design, being a lot more cognizant of the fact of, you know, any type of user experience, you know, design or deliverables that I'm doing. It really helps me be a lot more cognizant in terms of the people that I'm working with, you know, either hand in hand, you know, collaborating with developers, you know, at the current time, or anybody who's going to receive anything, you know, that I'm designing. It, you know, I think even though I'm not going to do anything that would impress probably you or your audiences, it is something that I like to think makes me better at what I end up doing.
So you have done a whole lot of different things. And my feeling is that you have not studied computer programming in a formal environment. You've probably also not studied user experience in a formal environment. I'm saying that because I don't know if anybody's actually teaching that. So what was your education like?
Yeah, you know, I actually went to school thinking I was going to be a painter. To give you an idea in terms of age, so I'll be 45 this year. So I'd actually gone to Columbus College of Art and Design. As I mentioned, I started off wanting to be a painter. I ended up graduating with an advertising degree. Then I was primarily a creative director for a while. I was in Chicago, was in some of the ad firms out there. And then I've been back in the Columbus area now for about 5 years. If I'm getting to kind of the crux of, if I think what you're asking is to say, like, yeah, I kind of migrated into doing user experience maybe about, I would say, close to 15 years ago or so, where it was more called IA work or information architecture. And user experience has essentially evolved out of that as well as a few other disciplines.
Do you think your education was helpful? It wasn't directly related to what you're doing right now, but did it help?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's like I think most people find themselves in their careers at a certain time wondering if their formal education helped. You know, I don't think that's an affliction that I only have. I think it did. You know, I would have to kind of go back to the fact to say that there's adjacencies, you know, with what I learned. I mean, the idea of being able to say, for instance, like the research perspective, that I had some wonderful copywriting instructors when I was in school. And even though that may not sound on the surface that it's related, it is a method of again, kind of this kind of term I've thrown around a few times already called structured thinking. But to say that, you know, to be able to kind of go through and really ferret out what is the data that you're working with and then trying to, you know, arrange that or rearrange it in some new way. If that happens to be written prose for copywriting, if that happens to end up being, you know, a formal research project or information architecture and UX design. These things kind of come often from a common origin, even though the results, you know, are often different.
I think I'm really excited to have you here because you are a user experience expert, and I have my opinions on user experience.
Oh, I'd love to hear them. Yes, yes.
It's very general. It's nothing very specific. I've read parts of your book, and I'm completely overwhelmed. I don't think I can talk to you about user experience. But my idea of user experience is the quality of interactions that a user goes through that results in a satisfactory outcome, and that's very subjective. So in my worldview, every user interaction should result in a happy customer. It should result in a customer that's able to achieve the goal that he or she set out to do when using the application. And that should be done in a way that's compliant. So again, very vague. In my world, if your application is slow and it forces the user to change their behavior, their normal activities, to just to work with your application, that is a negative user or bad user experience that will count. So I will count that as user experience. A lot of people, I know that so many people have no clue about user experience, and they probably think that it's something to do with user interfaces, which it is, kind of, yes, but UI and UX have one thing in common, that's you.
Certainly, yeah, the user.
So I'm not going to tell you what user experience is. I'm going to tell you from a layperson's point of view. My point of view, I think that I should know how to create a good user experience for my users. I don't know it right now. I have some vague ideas, but that's why we need people like you, and we need more people to go into user experience design. That's why I was really interested in having you on, so you can inspire some people, and hopefully a lot of our listeners can just think about it, they read your book, and then perhaps start working as user experience designers, and perhaps you can mentor them.
Well, yeah, you know, and I think, you know, if I could just, you know, throw out a courtesy to you, I think your explanation was very spot on. You know, and I think often, you know, the only thing I would end up saying is that everything you said was exactly correct. The only, you know, additional rub, you know, in terms of the practice of user experience professionally, is that it's not only giving a user what they want. You know, you mentioned a couple really good qualities in terms of the fact of saying, like, the efficiency of something, making sure that it's fast. Now, say, for instance, you know, a well-performing application, even poorly designed, is far better than a poorly performing application, you know, well-designed. You know, so it's like often one of the most efficient ways you can improve a user experience is just make your application fast, you know, because there's a concept that people often refer to as being failing fast, you know, where, as you can imagine, you know, if you're using a very performant system and you're constantly clicking around and you're not finding what you want, well, that's annoying, but it's far better than clicking around, not finding what you're wanting and having to wait to find out that it was wrong, you know? So those things are very good. And I think the one thing I was mentioning that was a little bit different from the professional application user experience design, it's not only are you going for a customer, you know, to feel satisfied, to feel that their goals are being met, but you're also, again, reconciling them with the goals of a business. Because one of the examples I often end up using when I'm talking to user experience with folks that are trying to get their head around it is it's a bit of a simplistic example, but what I often tell people to do is imagine an iPhone app or an Android app that you're using, and it just has one button on it that says "Give me a dollar." Right now, everybody in the world would click that button as a user. You know, it'd be like, "Well, this is fantastic! I'm going to click the Give Me a Dollar button, and I'll get a dollar." You know, now every business in the world would love to have that button read "Give us a dollar." Right, whereas essentially every user is going to hit that button and they're going to give the business a dollar. Well, neither one of those cases is going to be worthwhile, right? You know, if you hit a button and you got a dollar each time, that business would go out of business pretty quickly. And if you were to give a dollar and get nothing in return, as a user, you're not being paid off. So there has to be some form of reconciling, you know, this kind of value. I often try to bring it right down to kind of the central notions of reciprocation, where, you know, even in a conversation like we're having, like, you're a very generous guy, we talk back and forth We wait for each other to, you know, speak and hear what we have to say. Like that type of communication also happens with software and user experience and things like that. And you very much know when a system that you're using is not really reciprocating for your time and value that you're putting into it. And also vice versa. You know, it's like there's some applications that you're thinking, okay, there's just a pure entertainment value. And you kind of wonder, well, how will they ever make money? Or how will they stay in business? That there generally is that balance of trying to reconcile those two particular things, a business goal with a user goal. Does that make sense?
It sure does. I think that we may need to have you come to this podcast a couple of times for us to, you know, dig really deep into the psyche, you know, what we need to have in our head in order to produce good user experiences. I think that this is a very deep topic. I wanted to ask you about, you know, how you keep your skills up to date. I know that you do a ton of reading, you do a lot of research, and you're dabbling into programming, iPhone development, and you have client work, which is not related to this. And I mean, you have a busy life. How do you keep your skills up to date?
Yeah, you know, I would say I'm probably not that unique, you know, in regards to trying to keep these things up to date. I do probably have a little bit more time, you know, available to me as a consultant than I have if I was doing from 9 to 5. So what I'll end up doing is that I'm probably like lynda.com's like biggest user. So, you know, even though there's all sorts of great sources, but and lynda.com is obviously a robust one that people have known about for a long time. But that is to me is just endlessly fascinating, is that you can just tap into a set of, you know, tutorials and screencasts to pick up anything. You know, anecdotally, it's probably easiest to talk about the fact that, so say for instance, even just this last weekend, I've had enough like PHP knowledge. I was able to kind of like build my, you know, website, which again is fairly static. There's really nothing going on. You know, it's all that interesting. It's mostly a series of PHP includes. But I wanted to start playing around with an application that I've been kind of toying around with, kind of like a document management app. And, you know, something like a lynda.com can spawn like the basic knowledge of like PHP, you know, in terms of connecting with databases and things like that. You know, and within a matter of hours, you can have a functional knowledge. I mean, again, nothing, you know, professionally viable like you or your audiences would be able to put together. But again, it's enough for me to kind of, you know, engage into something and kind of learn some of the ins and outs, you know, of dealing with one particular type of language. And then that generally then ends up just spawning me to start just Googling the heck out of stuff. You know, so it's like I run into something and I don't know what it is, and I find something on Stack Overflow, you know, or something along that lines. You know, that type of, trying to think of like a more articulate way to refer to it, but it's like almost like task-based learning. And I think you had mentioned it, you know, in a really great podcast you had done recently. I think it was with Derek Bailey, you know, and you talked about this kind of like just-in-time learning, is that a lot of that type of stuff, you know, really resonates with me too, because it's like I do love picking up a book and reading it from cover to cover. But often for a lot of things, which I don't necessarily personally have a whole lot of knowledge with in terms of a lot of development languages, I often find that if I'm trying to build something, that's the thing that kind of gets me into learning something. Is that I'm trying to take care of a particular task, and it allows me to kind of at least, again, ferret out, you know, enough knowledge to be able to build something and take a look at it and see if it's worth anybody's time.
That's a really good point. And as you mentioned, the just-in-time learning idea is that you only learn the thing that you need right now. And you don't learn for the sake of learning. And I've done both. Mm-hmm. You know, I love to learn. So I often learn for the sake of learning because I'm so curious. I just want to know.
Yeah.
But I know that it takes a toll on my time and my own sanity. And
agreed.
Sometimes I don't do that. I then learn as I need to learn. If I'm building a type of website, if I need authentication for that, then I learn how to do authentication. Mm-hmm. Before that, that shouldn't be my concern, simply because I can't possibly learn everything, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just a huge wealth of, you know, things for us to tap into. And I think, you know, every human being has that challenge, you know, in their life. I think there are people that are inherently more curious than others. But I think most folks, it's just like you really do run into a situation where there just isn't enough time, you know, to be able to learn everything you want. I mean, I often, and I don't know if this would resonate with you at all, but what I try to end up doing is almost kind of like triage it in a way, is to say, you know, there's things I have to do to kind of keep my lights on. you know, as a consultant. And that, you know, is kind of more of like the, you know, following up with, you know, kind of industry leaders and kind of knowing what, frankly, trends are and the different kind of, you know, lexical conventions that people are using to kind of describe, you know, what they do. You know, all that type of stuff is like maybe like a first level. You know, the second is kind of what we're talking about, like this kind of just-in-time learning, like trying to solve particular tasks. But in a third way, you know, it's like what I'll end up trying to find is that, you know, with this whole exercise of me writing a book recently, is that I'll just pick up something which I'm weak at, but I've always been interested in. So like, I, you know, I picked up a book about economics a while ago, and it was learning about Vilfredo Pareto, and, you know, like it's the guy that kind of created the 80-20 rule, and like the whole background behind that type of information was really fascinating to me. And that's a form of learning, but it was actually, you know, as you mentioned, you can get exhausted if all your learning is just doing what's kind of keeping your lights on, you know, and some people are better at it than myself, but it's like, I think that there's this kind of way that you can kind of find these kind of various levels of learning where you're like, okay, this is the type of learning which is kind of keeping me gainfully employed. This is the stuff I need to do, you know, kind of get my projects done. And then there's this third level, which I think, you know, people can be a little bit looser about and just find topics, you know, that are interesting to them, but don't necessarily contribute to the first two. Can be kind of a way of kind of keeping that momentum up. Because I am a big believer in the fact is that you build up momentum, you know, I think for learning a lot of times. And if you're used to picking up a book every week or two, it's a lot easier to kind of keep that going than not do that type of stuff or not watch tutorials or whatever it is. So if you kind of keep that as a regular, almost like exercise regime, it allows you, I think, to get a lot through a lot more material. But that's maybe just a personal belief.
Oh, that's an excellent point. You have to schedule this learning. And it's not just going to happen. And I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about in general. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If someone says that in my free time, quote unquote, in my free time, I will learn X, then there's a very strong possibility that you will never have free time.
Agreed.
Because yeah. If free time means that I'm not doing anything, then I don't have any time because I'm mm-hmm. always mm-hmm. doing something. Even if I'm watching TV, I'm doing something and I'm not free. But if it's in my schedule, if I say that before I go to bed, 1 hour before I go to bed, I do this thing. I read a book, for example. Mm-hmm. Then mm-hmm. that becomes a task for me. It's not my free time anymore. It's work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you treat learning as work, then you'll be in a position where you will, over time, you know, accumulate all of this learning that seems impossible. But imagine doing that for a whole month. Now you have 1 hour a day for 30 days. You have 30 hours of learning. That's incredible. Yeah, yeah. And I did that. I did that kind of stuff for many years. Before I had kids, it was much easier.
I can imagine, yeah.
And I was obsessed with learning because I felt like I needed to catch up to a lot of other people that I followed. And it was tiring. It was grueling. But it was really good for me. And I really enjoyed it at the end because I could look back and just see all of the different books I'd read. I would read a ton of books. And the other thing that I think we need to learn is not only that I need to, for example, if I am a Java developer or I want to be a Java developer, then I say that, okay, I'm going to pick up a book on Java and I'm going to read it. Or I'm going to go through a blog series, a tutorial, and I'm going to go through it, and that's my learning. There's life beyond that. So there, you think you're talking about something else. You're saying that, yes, you have to learn to keep the lights on, but you also have to learn other things to broaden your perspective, just to also give you, you know, this breadth of knowledge. And the other thing is that you need to learn how to learn or what to learn, actually. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. For example, in this, let's take web development as an example. Every 6 months, every year, the technology landscape changes. New languages, new frameworks come out, new tools, new tool chains. It's an unending, I want to call it a roller coaster ride, but I'm not even sure if it's a roller coaster. I think it just keeps going up. So it's the question is, how do I know what I should learn, right? If I know, for example, let's say that I'm a CSS expert and I learn everything there is to learn about CSS, and a new version of CSS comes out, then I'm on top of it. Great. Mm-hmm. I can certainly do that. But should I learn SAS? I don't know. What is SAS? Maybe I don't know what it is. And maybe I don't know if there's something even better on the horizon. Maybe I don't know if I should be learning a different set of technologies, techniques, ideas that I am not aware of. And so I think so. A lot of people that I know and admire, they talk about having this tunnel vision and being really focused, because when you're focused, you can go deep. And that is true. But you also need to go wide. So you have an idea of what's going on. What are the new developments? A lot of times, what's new is also better. It's not always true, but most of the time it is true. And new things come out and they catch on because they provide something that didn't exist before. And generally, it's an improvement. So I need to know, I need to stay on top of what everybody's doing, maybe at a very cursory level, and then go deep into one or two things so then I have some depth of knowledge. Especially in your case, because you are a consultant, you are expected to be an expert, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, it would be generous to call me an expert, you know, if anything. I mean, there's kind of a saying around, you know, it's not specifically with UX, but it's like the idea of being able to sell your ignorance, you know, which is like, it's not the idea that I'm going to walk into a situation and know a solution, but I'm going to know a set of skills to get to that solution, right? Because at that point, and I'm not saying it has a one-to-one equivalency with what you were just talking about in terms of like, you know, web scripting languages and such, but my guess, and again, tell me if I'm wrong, but it's like there is something we're saying that, you know, once you end up with, you know, build up kind of a body of knowledge, you know, these things are you taking on a new programming language or something new going on with Ruby, for instance, you're going to be able to essentially hit that ground running, you know, based off your current knowledge, where somebody such as myself would take, you know, potentially years, you know, to develop that level of aptitude to kind of be able to embrace those new things. So again, it's, I don't want to sound repetitive, but it's like, I really think it is kind of a matter of just managing that kind of cadence where you talked about, is to say like, you know, it's just a constant, like a spigot, you know, that's just throwing information at all of us, you know, that's like drinking out of a, you know, fire hose, you know. But it's like to be able to try to find that kind of way of saying, okay, well, how do you triage that? You know, like what are the things, as you mentioned, you know, to kind of know. And what I've kind of done, and again, I'm not necessarily saying this is any inherent wisdom, but it's like, you know, something, like I said, like a Lynda or like an Alista Part or something along that lines, or frankly, even Twitter, you know, like you begin to just start, there's like almost like a cascade of saying, okay, I'm hearing about this scripting language. I'm hearing about this particular type of technique. I'm hearing about this new derivation of agile, you know, or something along that lines. And I think often, because I've made this mistake before too, is I feel like I need to dive into that and learn all of it at once. And as you mentioned, that could be a really exhausting thing and probably ultimately, you know, an unwise way of going about things, because you just will run out of time. But it's just like the idea is to say, can you dip into it a little bit? Can you watch one tutorial video? can you read one blog post about these particular things and just begin to start filing it away? Because I think that way, when it does come into some application where it's more actionable, maybe something you have to use on the job, or you're attending a conference, or you've got a colleague that's really interested in something, it gives you that first hook, you know, into that knowledge base, rather than just treating everything as if it's just this one big nebulous cloud that you'll never, you know, be able to digest. Because like I said, I've made that mistake of just trying to only pick one thing and try to become an expert in it. And that does help, you know, from a specialization standpoint. But if you don't know it's immediately actionable, or you don't know it's going to be applicable on your job, you can often end up learning, you know, like say, for instance, again, just so I don't talk about this in such a vague way, like I was really into Flash for a while, you know, where I was like trying to learn, like this is before Adobe bought it, you know, where it was this kind of proprietary action script, you know, this is before they kind of switched over to more of an ECMA model. And that, you know, again, it helped me, you know, learn a structured thinking, but completely unmarketable now, you know. So it's like that type of thing can be something where I think sometimes people can kind of go down these primrose paths and learn a certain amount of knowledge, which they're just not going to be able to reuse.
That is true. And there's always a risk. And that's something people talk about, Meteor.js, as this JavaScript framework that nobody cares about anymore, but it was pretty popular at one point. You can say the same thing about any number of technologies. But what I've noticed is that every type of activity in the software development realm that I have done, even things that I really didn't want to do at all, they have always come back to help me in something else that I was doing later, and really in unexpected ways. So it's not lost effort, but it doesn't take you directly to your destination. If you want to be a top-notch, for example, if you want to be a top-notch iPhone developer, should you use Objective-C or Swift? Now you have a choice. It's not clear, and you have to make a pick. And let's say that you said, well, Objective-C is established. Let me do that. And by the time you got really good at it, everybody just dropped it and went to Swift. Then you'll be like, oh, okay, well, it's not completely lost, but you will lose some of that momentum. And that's something we all have to live with. Another thing that I want to say is that this becomes easy. If you had somebody to talk to, if you are going to a user group, if you had experienced people who have been around the block, they have seen these cycles come and go, and you could say, you know, this is my dilemma. What do you think? And that can help a little bit. And so wanted to see, talk about your first experience as a professional. I don't know, what was your job? Was it, it wasn't for UX, right?
Yeah. You know, as I think I mentioned at the start of the conversation is that I was primarily on the creative side of things. You know, I was doing essentially visual design, but, you know, for lack of a better way of describing it, I was just staying in Photoshop, right? So it's like I was building out interfaces and things like that. And that was just purely on the creative side. And what I often end up doing, and it probably sounds a little self-deprecating, but it really is true, is that I never was that good of a visual designer, and I was never that good of doing development. But somehow right in the middle of that is kind of UX and kind of IA. This is that, you know, you're dealing with kind of a merger of the aesthetic and behavioral and psychology, and then also being cognizant of development and things like that. That I'm not exactly sure if it's exactly in the middle of that, you know, but there is a spectrum. And I came into kind of doing UX and IA. Strangely enough, I was running a consulting practice in Chicago. And so I was leaving right after kind of the dot-com boom. I was working at a place, Organic, which is a large systems integrator, which is still around. But I was in their Chicago office. And they were closing up the office and had an opportunity to go out to San Francisco, but just decided to try to, you know, wing it from a consulting perspective. And there was still a fair amount of telecommunication clients and all right around year 2000. So what I ended up kind of coming into it more is just simply recognizing what my strengths were. And I kind of recognized that my strengths were primarily doing a lot of the research and trying to understand the way a system is going to perform and addressing a business and user needs. And that, I think, you know, eventually got stronger, you know, from a more dedicated, you know, pursuit of IA. And, you know, it was IA at that time. UX just simply wasn't a term that people were really throwing around that much. But I got into it primarily from consulting because I just recognized, like, hey, this is something I can sell. I feel like I'm better at doing this than visual design. I'm better at doing this than trying to sell development services. And it kind of just became, you know, something which allowed me to pursue a career.
Somebody out there might be thinking, why did Ed go into consulting? That's not the done thing. Most developers and most technical people that I know, they have never done it. Mm-hmm. So why did you do it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this time around, the consulting practice I had in Chicago was for several years. This time around, it was primarily to kind of have a little bit more time to write the book, as well as also pursue a bunch of passion projects, you know, as I mentioned. So I haven't always been a consultant, you know, throughout my entire career. Like I said, I've worked at traditional ad firms, product firms, different things like that. But consulting, you know, I think the one thing I'll kind of, you know, not to sell your audience on this, but it's like consulting gives you a chance to meet all sorts of interesting, you know, smart folks that are far smarter than myself, you know, just people that basically have pursued any number of different aptitudes, because it's like you can get into something where, you know, there's definitely different companies. I don't want to say that this is, you know, always the case, but, you know, sometimes when you're working with a team for a long period of time, you get a lot of benefit out of that, right? You get to make friends with folks. You get to really learn the ins and outs of of you know, how to most efficiently work with particular, you know, people. But the one thing that sometimes can work against that is that you begin to start your experience, you get a little bit of blinders on, right? Because it's like you might know a particular vertical or a particular, you know, sector. You might know a particular type of craft. And I would assume this is also applicable for the development community too. And then as a consultant, though, you're touching so many different people, you know, from different people's jobs across any number of different companies. And you can just kind of see the stuff that this may sound a little grandiose, but it's like you can kind of see what always works and what always fails. You know, you just see, you know, different teams and different personalities confront some of the same issues. But because they're literally under different roofs, you know, sometimes you can kind of see the way that, you know, some people can find success out of stuff that just seems completely dire. And then you can also see on the reverse of that, you can see people that take great opportunities and just completely squander them. And that's kind of hard to see if you're only working full time somewhere else. So it's like I guess the argument I'd make for consulting is that it's just a really unique vantage point to see any number of companies. You don't get the depth that you would have, you know, working full time. But you do certainly get a whole lot more insights just because you're just seeing so many more people and so many more companies confront some of the same issues.
I think it depends on the personality. There are certain people that are risk averse or they want stability. And consulting offers you the opportunity for flexibility in a high risk, high reward situation where you may make up a lot of money or you may not make a lot of money, but you'll definitely have your freedom. And if you're really good and if you're busy, then you'll end up making more money than a full-time developer. But I'm thinking there's a whole bunch of people out there that they think that they are the type that will do well as consultants, but they're starting out. I mean, don't you need to be an expert? Don't you need to have 10 years experience? Don't you need to have a huge portfolio before you can go into consulting? What do you think?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And as you mentioned, I think a lot of it is, like you said, personality, you know, the risk aversion versus wanting something a little bit more stable. You know, it's really hard to say. I mean, because it's like I can't really speak too much from a particular development side of things. I think sometimes there can be a real advantage to working full time for especially people starting off, because you mentioned, you know, they may not have a whole lot of experience. They may not have built up, you know, practical people skills, you know, different things like that that you really do get, you know, in your first couple jobs. So starting off can be a little precarious. You know, I had a couple months ago did like kind of a entrepreneur kind of consulting speaking engagement. And I think, well, you know about that, Arsalan, but just for your audience. And one of the things I kind of brought up about that is to say that, you know, from a, when you start consulting is that the most expensive part of consulting is looking for work. Right. So it's the hours that you're just blowing, you know, trying to impress people or have a presentation or making, you know, sales phone calls and stopping in and doing little dog and pony shows, that type of stuff. I mean, sometimes it can be kind of nice, you know, as a change of pace, but it's expensive because you're not billing, you know, at that time, you're not really making any money. So I think the thing that can kind of help when you maybe have a few years under your belt, like myself, is that I just simply have a group of people that I know and trust, and they have work and they have particular needs that I can help them fulfill. And hopefully they like and trust me in a reciprocal way. So it's just like, it's just a value exchange. So it's just, it happens to be, yes, I am a consultant. And so I have a separate LLC that they're paying opposed to giving me a paycheck. But in many ways, I try to keep it, you know, fairly seamless where I'm just, you know, hopefully a member of the team. I'm just not a member of the team that works in their office. So
I think that hopefully this will inspire a lot of young folks to think about taking up user experience as a career. And as Ed says, get a job first, get some experience under your belt, build up your people skills, and by all means, go into consulting if that's what you want to do. But be aware that you will sometimes not have money.
Well, yeah, I mean, you don't want to go into it, you know, in a volunteer, you know, effort, you know, just like, I mean, it's the idea is you do run into the practicalities of saying, you know, keeping the lights on, like I mentioned earlier. But yeah, I mean, I think as you mentioned, it really very much depends on your particular set of skills, you know, in terms of like what type of money you can make and really what the market ends up needing. But in so many ways, and you could talk about it in like a vast spectrum. You talk about like the Uberization of the economy and, you know, the gig economy and things like that, is that there are parts of the parts of the economy which are moving to increasingly having more and more kind of consultants. And so it just, I think it really just depends on what you're trying to do and what kind of fits best for, you know, as you mentioned, you know, your risk aversion, how you want to pursue things. You know, in fact, like right now, it's like, I just, you know, like I've mentioned before, it's like, I'm just a big nerd with two cats, you know? So it's just like, I don't have the practical concerns, you know, of kind of, sometimes having like a family, you know, involved, where that can be really distracting for some folks. I mean, as wonderful as it is, you know, trying to get a lot of work done where you have, you know, family commitments and children to attend to and things like that, that can be kind of difficult, you know, for people from a consulting perspective. So I don't want to say it's for everybody.
For somebody who's looking to get their first job in software development, perhaps user experience after listening to this interview, and they're concerned, maybe they have concerns about being accepted as a new developer and being appreciated. Maybe they're concerned that it will be very, you know, a difficult environment, not nurturing, not enabling, and they will be found out. There's an imposter syndrome thing going on. What do you think about the state of affairs in software development shops or any other technical companies? When new developers or new technical people come in, are they nurtured? Are they enabled? Or is it sink or swim, and we're just going to get rid of half the people who don't make the grade, which I know that a lot of Silicon Valley style companies do that. Amazon does that, which is not Silicon Valley, but Amazon really, I think on a yearly basis, they just get rid of the people they consider to perform the lowest. So the concept of job security, there's no concept of job security in certain companies. Sure. But I want to know from your perspective, what have you seen?
Yeah, you know, probably nothing all that illuminating, but, you know, it really varies. You know, I think there are, you know, trend lines you end up seeing. It's like sometimes they kind of, you know, track against the economy in terms of saying, like, you know, when I give you, again, an idea of going back, you know, a few years, like right before the dot-com boom, right, I remember, you know, companies that would be trying to poach web developers and designers by parking like ice cream trucks in front of other, you know, competitors' offices and staffing them with recruiters. they just really wanted people. And it was the whole, you know, it was the heyday of things where they had, you know, foosball tables everywhere. And like, it was just like every night was basically like a, you know, a nightclub, you know, kind of thing, which I think you even talked about that in one of your prior, you know, interviews. But it's just like, and there's, you know, good and bad to all these type of qualities. And that, you know, very much leaned towards the employee, you know, and I think, you know, and this is me pontificating a little bit, so please excuse, you know, me and your audience, you know, the trend line, because the economy has swung so much more towards the employer over the past couple of years, but now that's beginning to change again, you know, so it's a bit of this kind of pendulum swing. But I think, you know, when people kind of come in, you know, to a new office, as you mentioned, it's like, I've often just, you know, like the rare opportunities I've had where I've gotten a chance to kind of mentor folks or people coming right out of college, is to say that it's like, it really kind of becomes, this sounds a little huggy feely, but it's like, it's relationships you have with people, you know, because it's just that the general idea is to say, like, if you can function, you know, based on performing your job, right, you know, just the kind of, you know, the checkbox kind of thing of like, okay, we would need somebody to do X, X, and X, you know, if you can do that type of stuff, it really becomes a matter of just managing the relationships of the people you interact with every day, you know. So I think not only is it from a practical sense that it makes you, you know, more employable and be able to stay employed, is as if you know, get along with your coworkers, and you obviously you're trying to support them and treat them well, and hopefully they're treating you well the same way. And that can, you know, I think help, you know, folks, is if they just focus on the relationships of the people that they interact with every day. But other than that, you know, and that's kind of a broad, you know, like I mentioned, huggy feely kind of advice. But, you know, just constantly learn, you know, focus on your craft, and then just try to treat people well. And I think most of, you know, the other kind of macro forces that you're talking about, where you have these kind of tectonic shifts, like, you know, like a big company like an Amazon or a GE, or even an ad agency or something that might lose an account and have to clip, you know, 100 people. Those type of things you're never really in control of as an employee anyways. You know, and I think most people know that. So I just end up saying, don't even spend much time worrying about it. You know, just try to protect yourself in the sense of saying, you know, have enough savings that if all of a sudden something quickly evaporates that you're not going to be destitute. But the rest of it is just like, I think, simply managing, you know, the relationships that, with the people that you have, that you work with.
And have good relationships with your parents.
Yeah, I think that could always help too. So yeah.
If you lose all your money, you need a place to go. So,
I see where you're going. I think that's very helpful.
Have good relationships with your parents, because you never know, you may need to move back in. So I wanted to ask you about your ideas on software development as a career for someone who is curious, but intimidated. And also want to ask you the same question about user experience. I don't know if it's an established field in the sense that there are lots of jobs for user experience people. You can tell me if that is true. And if it is true, that I want to know, how do you rate those?
Yeah. So let's, you know, if I understand correctly, you know, there's kind of two parts. So it's kind of like the software kind of development, you know, as a career field and kind of getting into it is that, you know, I think I wouldn't be the first person to say, and far smarter people than me have said this, is that it really, you know, an increasing number of service-based economy jobs that you're going to probably end up seeing here now, as well as several decades, have some type of technical correlation to it. You know, as if you're a traditional software developer, if you're, you know, a visual designer, you know, you're probably going to be doing something digital. If you're a copywriter, you're probably going to be doing something digital. You know, it's like there's obviously, you know, other trade crafts, you know, that don't necessarily touch digital work, but certainly being in software development is a worthy goal and probably keep you employed through, you know, the vast part of your, you know, working life. I would say from the second part of the question you had in terms of UX, it fascinates me. I mean, it's truly one of those things, and this sounds a little Pollyannish, but it's like, I'm just so happy it's this career, because it feels like it's the only thing I'm good at, or at least I feel that I'm good at. And it's something that, you know, I really honestly probably would be doing even if I wasn't being paid for it. You know, it's like, it just really engages me on any number of different levels. The career, you know, in terms of the jobs, yeah, there's a lot of jobs out there, you know, for UX folks. And as you mentioned, the kind of offshoots or kind of adjacencies with UX in terms of UI and things along that lines, research, different things along that lines. It seems to definitely be something where UX as a, you know, kind of as a, you know, people are becoming more aware of it, you know, and as you had started off, you know, our conversation with is to say, not a whole lot of people really know what it is. But it is getting more into kind of the public lexicon. You know, people are starting to realize that user experience roles are being hired, that, you know, the reason why sometimes some software succeeds and sometimes fails is often, you know, assigned to, you know, by having a good or poor user experience. So I think, you know, you're seeing more of it. I mean, I would say, you know, similar to one of our parts of a conversation we had, you know, maybe about 15 minutes ago, when I was talking about the fact is that UX in of itself, even though the term has been around for several decades, really most people that were probably doing UX 15, 20 years ago, we're really calling it probably more like IA, you know, like information architecture or cognitive engineering. You have cultural anthropology, you even have people from doing library science, you know, and things. There's any number of different forays into doing kind of UX. But, you know, in another 10, 20 years from now, I think UX is a term. It's made enough, you know, of a place in the market that I think it's probably still going to be used. But, you know, you get these kind of, you know, hybridization roles where you have some really talented folks, you know, like both you and I go to the Columbus Web Group here, which is the local, you know, kind of group for web professionals. And you see some folks that are just amazingly capable and talented. And when they're, you know, like Kevin Mack and Adam Weiss to kind of run Columbus Web Group, you know, it's like they're both really talented folks from strategy and development perspective, and they're doing front end and back end and all that. So it's just like you have these kind of, you know, hybrid roles I think, happening all over the place. And it's also happening within UX. So again, I'm probably talking myself in a corner, but like in 10, 20 years from now, I don't know exactly what it'll be, but I think the role and the career of UX will definitely be around. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's far greater than it is now.
I think that's a pretty interesting perspective. This industry is evolving. The technologies and techniques are evolving. Obviously, if we go away from the World Wide Web and there's something else in its place, or the websites don't look the way they look right now, this user experience design, everything will change. So yeah, we'll keep an eye on that. I wanted to ask you about mentorship. We didn't really talk about mentorship. Did you ever get mentored by somebody?
Yeah, you know, I would say, like, in the kind of more formal sense, I would say that I did, you know, like when I was in Chicago, one of the agencies I was with, one of the agency presidents, I think, was giving me a lot of really good advice. I think I was probably too young and naive, you know, or at least for me. You know, I'm not saying that everybody my age would have been that naive, but at least I was, to really recognize the benefits, you know, of having somebody mentor me. But I think, you know, anytime you're talking about somebody that's been through some of the same, you know, risks and opportunities, it's always really helpful. And then I would say, in an informal sense, I approach almost anybody that I'm talking to as being a potential mentor, just because there's so much you can learn just from another individual. So I regularly try to get coffee and, you know, lunch with folks and all that, just simply because I just kind of want to tap their, you know, their knowledge reserves and kind of, you know, see what their take is on any number of popular issues. So I guess in that way, that's more of an informal mentorship.
Are you an outgoing person?
No. I mean, I try to fake it, you know, when I'm out at public events, but I'm pretty much just like a, you know, like a classic introvert, and not like in the cool, like Atari wearing t-shirt type of introvert. Like I'm just an introvert.
This,
you know,
is exactly how I thought of you. This is why I asked this question, because you're doing something, you know, consulting requires interaction with people. You're able to perform that role, even though it's not natural. It's not your natural disposition to go out there and be public. But if you are mentoring people, then you will need to come out and come out of your comfort zone a little bit. And so expose yourself a little bit. Show people a little bit of your personal side, and maybe maybe expose yourself to potentially being found out. That's where imposter syndrome comes in, where you feel like, you know, people think I'm all that and I'm not all that. And if I'm out there and talking to people and helping them, they'll eventually ask me a question I wouldn't know anything about, and then they will know that I'm an imposter. Do you go through that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think everybody does. I mean, there's definitely things that I feel less imposter, you know, about, you know, I mean, things that I feel slightly more confident with. But I think it's like, you know, some of that might even just be, you know, part of the human condition, you know, is that you inherently are approaching kind of new areas, you know, of knowledge, and until you really feel as if you're, you know, fully fluent in them, everybody's going to feel, you know, a bit like an imposter. But the way I always kind of do it, and again, not necessarily saying there's some particular wisdom to this, but it's like, as honest as you can be with yourself about where you currently are, I think is where you can reduce the stress. Because I remember years ago, somebody telling me, like, kind of the definition of stress was the gap between what you perceive life should be and where you think you are now. You know, so it's like that idea is to say, oh, I really wish I was, you know, across that hill somewhere, and you're feeling as if you're somehow falling back behind, or some grand scorecard is evaluating your career path, you know. But it's like, as much as you can be, just be honest about yourself, I think a lot of that imposter, you know, kind of syndrome can dissipate. Because, you know, I try to be as clear as possible when I'm talking to somebody and say, you know, hey, here's what I know. Here's a million other things I'm terrible at, or I'm just completely ignorant of. And I think if you know that going into, you know, your career and conversations, that kind of imposter syndrome, you know, isn't going to be something that's going to, you know, cripple you. You know, it's like you can still effectively, you know, operate in an environment where you're a low information participant, but still feels if you're kind of contributing and, you know, ultimately kind of, you know, moving something forward opposed to, you know, pulling it back.
Yeah, I think that's really excellent advice. And I would say that if you have imposter syndrome, if you have stress, that you are falling behind your peers, you can use that to, you know, to give you this little fire in your belly to, you know, to say, I will make up for that. I will go and I will learn this thing. I know that if you don't have that stress and if you feel accomplished, if you have that, you're talking about the difference between where you want to be and where you are, and well, if there is no difference, it means you have achieved everything you wanted to achieve. What is there to live for, right? So,
so that's pretty deep. I guess not to interrupt you, but it was things like I think it just make sure I'm not, you know, drawing some false equivalencies. Is that I'm not trying to say, you know, it's like you feel unstressed and then basically you just give up and you play Xbox all day. You know, I'm just saying it's more of something is to say, like, you know, if you can be honest with yourself really about what are your skill sets, you know, and how do you actually feel that you can kind of participate and, you know, make the world a better place, for lack of a better term, you know, or just help a project move forward. If you know that, then you'll be much more aware of, like, well, here's where you need to improve. I think it's just that most folks, you know, are just everybody, you know, is just kind of imperfect creatures. This is that there's, if you internalize that stuff and you're not recognizing it or being honest with yourself, it can cause a lot of stress. You know, it's like imposter syndrome can be really, really crippling if it begins to start altering your behaviors in ways that you're not fully aware of. You know, like if you're not going to go out and, you know, reach out to somebody and make a conversation with them just simply because you've internally felt that somehow you're deficient in some way. But if you can kind of bring that stuff to the light of day, you know, it's I think it makes it far less stressful for people.
This is excellent advice. Once again, from Edward Stull, and we're at the 1 hour mark. This has been really amazing. I do want to ask you some of the questions I normally ask. So just to get your quick answers, do you like any podcasts, screencasts, blogs, anything that you recommend?
Yeah, like all of them. it's something to the point. I mean, of course I like yours, you know, as we just mentioned actually before our conversation today, it's like, I'm really learning a lot, you know, listening to a number of the folks that you had on, have been really, really helpful because again, I have colleagues of mine, you know, including yourself, you know, that I can have conversations about, but really knowing kind of the deep in and outs of, different folks that I'll probably never have a chance to meet. I mean, I think recently you had that one with the younger junior developer Pavlov that I thought was really informative. And hopefully I'm pronouncing her name correctly. It was Hawa Youssef, you know, which is accomplished probably more in her few years than I probably will before I die. You know, it's like, you know, hearing all these type of things are really helpful, you know, so it's just like, you know, hopefully it doesn't sound like I'm blowing smoke up your pant leg, but I really enjoy your podcast. You know, I listen to a ton. There's one called The Spoolcast, which is Jared Spool, who's kind of a god in the UX, you know, IA community, really, really smart fellow. There's Bogue World, which is a really great podcast for, again, IA UX. You know, there's a ton of one. You know, there's Freakonomics, there's Intelligence Squared, the US debates, you know, 99% Invisible is another really great one. You know, which is primarily talking about the, you know, essentially design and architecture and the way things are kind of constructed and delving into some engineering as well too. But there's so many of them. I feel like I could probably just fill up another hour of your podcast, talking about all the stuff that I really enjoy.
This is really good. For folks who are interested in listening to the episodes that you're talking about, let me give you the URLs. So the one with Pavlo, he's a new developer. You can find that at mentoringdevelopers.com/episode5. And the one with Hawa, she is the entrepreneur who is really driven and started a company. And she was just graduated just a few years ago. And her episode is at mentoringdevelopers.com/episode4. If you like the show, if you like the interviews, if you'd like us to continue, please go ahead and subscribe using your podcatcher of choice. And if you can, go into iTunes and leave a review, give us a rating. That will help us hopefully get the word out and let more other people benefit from it. What's the best advice you have, Edward, for software companies looking to hire new developers?
Yeah, you know, I think this is, again, probably nothing so surprising, but just to be kind of more engaged in the community, you know, where it's like, I was actually just talking to two colleagues myself where they were actually looking to hire somebody on their team. And they were saying like, oh, you know, that their HR departments, you know, were really great, but they didn't really know the type of questions to ask, you know, for like UX or kind of maybe from a development perspective. So I'd say, you know, if you've got a company that's looking to try to hire somebody, just try to be involved in a lot of these kind of community functions, you know, participate in some of these things. Like I said, like Columbus Web Group, at least here locally in Columbus, is really helpful. The IXDA community around here is really helpful too. If you're looking for UX or IA folks, but that's generally the best way, you know, is that I think it's similar to almost all sorts of different things in life. If you're trying to come into it blindly, it's going to feel like you're walking uphill. But if you're already part of the group of people you're trying to engage with, then those distances become much shorter.
Yeah. I've always thought that the idea of having somebody completely clueless about what we're doing and then have them the ability and the power to hire us, that mm-hmm. sounded really ludicrous. I mean, nobody likes recruiters because they have no idea what they're talking about.
And some. I'm not to debate the point, but I've worked with a couple that are really, some really, really nice folks. And even in Columbus, there's some recruiters that are pretty top notch. But you are right. You know, it's like a lot of traditional recruiters and HR departments that have low engagement with the community. They just simply don't know what to ask or how to evaluate colleagues.
Well, so it's more fun to talk in generalizations.
Well, sure, of course.
Obviously, there are exceptions. But in general, people don't like recruiters, of course. There are some good recruiters. I know some personally. They're very good and very nice and respectful and knowledgeable. But generally, it's not the case. And I know why, because they have never done programming. They have never been in a technical environment. All they have done is sales. So my recommendation, nobody's asking for it, I'm just giving it to you.
And
feel free to use it. If you're a recruiter or if you're a manager at a company, feel free to use this advice. Pay your developers to be your recruiters. Pay your developers. Mm-hmm. I know why people don't do that, because developers are expensive. But they're also people that are best suited to hire other developers, not recruiters. Recruiters can do the paperwork. They can do a lot of the mundane things, but the initial contact, I think, should always be with a peer.
No, it's an excellent point.
And what's your best advice for new and aspiring developers and user experience designers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I'd say probably the same for both, actually, is that, you know, when you start off, and it's kind of sage advice that you probably hear from a lot of folks, but is to not pigeonhole yourself too early on. You know, I think it's the idea is that, you know, the getting the fundamentals down, you know, in your first few years are going to pay off throughout your career. But I would end up saying too, and hopefully this is an antithetical to that advice, but it's like sometimes it does help to find one specialization which makes you highly marketable, you know, especially when you're young, because And this doesn't necessarily sound that exotic, but it's like sometimes if you can specialize in something that you think a group of folks don't necessarily want to do, you know, where you can kind of come in and be like, hey, I'm the solution to, you know, the problem you're having. That can be a really, you know, good marketable technique for somebody who's young, you know, coming into a group, is just to find a, you know, a very marketable specialization on something that other people aren't necessarily doing or don't want to do. But in general, just kind of keeping your eyes open for these things, because as we talked about, you know, somebody starting off now coming out of college, you know, they're going to be working for, you know, 40, 50 years. And, you know, what's it going to look like, you know, a couple decades from now? The fundamentals probably won't change, but the particular software and particular techniques probably will.
Is there anything you'd like to promote? I know that you have a book and I really want you to talk about it. So not only that, hopefully you'll have some buyers, but also mm-hmm. we will promote user experience and people will learn a ton. This is let me just say a couple of things about this book. This is a book that's, part of it is available online for free, and you have recorded some audio that is amazing. And I'm amazed by the artwork and the way it's put together. I haven't looked at the printed copy. I don't know if you have it, but talk to us about your book. Why did you write it? And and where can we find it?
Yeah, well, you know, thank you very much. That's very kind of you to say. I mean, I have about the first kind of 10 sections. They're not necessarily directly chronological, but they're kind of first 10 sections of the book. There's effectively 10 stories that I kind of start off with. The book in itself has a bit over 50 or so. And what I try to end up doing is that there's all sorts of really good UX books out there, probably far better than anything I've written or capable of writing. But what I try to end up doing is to try to speak to folks that are doing development, that are doing project management, that are doing that may be account side or clients, and to try to essentially talk about certain UX concepts in a more story-based form. So a very, very quick one, you know, is to be able to cover is to say, like, there's a lot of things people talk about from, like, user journeys and customer journeys, and that can seem like a pretty opaque topic to a number of folks. But I'm using an example of this marathon in France that everybody runs, and they happen to run it inebriated. They tend to drink while they're on this marathon, and that actually becomes a pretty applicable analogy to talk about user experience and actually journey maps. So what I'm trying to do primarily is that almost kind of trick folks into being interested about user experience concepts by talking about things from history, culture, the arts, and try to bring that back down to a concept that people feel like they can internalize a little bit and then hopefully be able to use in their own jobs and feel like when they have to participate in these conversations that they come to the table with a little bit more knowledge about UX.
And is the book out yet or are you still writing it?
Yeah, so the book has actually been written for probably about 6 months or so. If anybody's actually, you know, in your audience has gone through the process of writing nonfiction trade, a lot of it is based on platform, you know, which is short. It's just your marketability for the book. So the book has been written, and I mentioned I've got about 10 parts up right now. Now I'm just trying to build a platform and kind of awareness for it, generate interest and readers on folks. There's always the option for anybody, you know, who does publishing is to go with self-publishing. But I've been looking for a traditional publisher, and that can take a little bit of while because I'm maybe not as accomplished as some other folks that might be working, you know, in a university setting or something like that, which generally tends to be the platform that a lot of nonfiction trade comes out of. So I'm trying to grow up that audience base, and any of your audience who would like to read any of those portions or listen to those portions we talked about, certainly be appreciated, as well as the feedback anybody has on that, because it's, you know, having eyeballs on this stuff is what it's all about.
This is great. What I will do is I will create a special link for our listeners to go to your book so that they don't have to memorize something complicated. So
thank you. Yes, yes.
I will set it up. Let me just say that right now. Let's give it mentoringdevelopers.com/UX. So if you go to mentoringdevelopers.com/UX, I will put some links that we talked about, and I will put the link for Ed's book and his Twitter account, which is ESDC. So if you go to Twitter, search for @ESDC, that's Edward's Twitter handle. And what do? You use Twitter to promote your work? What do you use it for?
Yeah. I mean, I would say, you know, kind of a mix between promotion and, like I said, just kind of staying engaged with folks. I tend to end up having a pretty high follow back count because it's like I really like to participate in conversations with people rather than just using Twitter as a broadcast mechanism, which other people might be better at it than myself. But I feel kind of dirty if I'm doing too much promotion via my Twitter account. So I do try to mix it up a little bit. But just ESDC is the one that most people can find me. So
what I would recommend is that you create a hashtag for your book. And every time you want to talk about your book, then you use that hashtag. That way, if I'm not interested in your other types of tweets, I'll just look at your hashtag tweet. So that could be a strategy that you could use.
That's a good idea, Arslan. Thank you.
So go to mentoringdevelopers.com/UX for all of the wonderful things that Ed talked about, especially his book, and get that book if you can. Is there a way to buy this book? I haven't seen a way to buy this book.
Well, yeah, not yet. You know, as I mentioned, right now the full book has been written, but it's actually not in publication yet. So
can you still sell it though? I mean, I know that it's not in publication, but what if it's an ebook? It's written. And maybe people just want to read it as an ebook.
Oh, yeah, certainly I think that could be an option here within the next few months. Yeah, I mean, if I go in the self-publishing route, exactly as you mentioned it, I mean, at this point, you know, and again, I wouldn't want to, you know, belabor the conversation with all the intricacies of platforming and going through a traditional publishing. But as you, as well as maybe some of your audience members know, it's a bit of an involved process. So at the current time right now, I think most people can get a pretty good taste of it from those kind of 10 sections that I've got up on the site now. And the rest of it, hopefully it just, you know, expands, you know, the topics for the future book. And I'd very much be happy to say that it'll be, you know, published here in the next couple months, but I'm still waiting to see.
Okay. So if you want to learn more about it, go to mentoringdevelopers.com/UX. When it is for sale, then we will update that page, hopefully. Now, do you want to promote anything else? Is there anything else that you're working on that you'd like people to know?
You know, no, not currently. Like I said, currently right now, you know, my main focus has been actually, you know, getting this book written. And then, as I mentioned, doing some consulting services. But I always enjoy, you know, connecting with new colleagues. And as mentioned, Twitter is probably the best way of getting a hold of me. But from a promotion standpoint, I'll spare your audience from anything more than the book.
We have taken so much of your time, and I really enjoyed talking to you. And I'm sure that people out there who are listening, they would have learned a lot. And hopefully, we'll have you back at some point and talk about your future adventures. Until then, we will see you later.
Thanks so much, Arsalan. I really enjoyed it.
Bye.
Bye bye.
So that was my interview with Edward Stull. I hope you enjoyed it. I really enjoyed doing the interview. And I'd really love for you to join the show. Be a guest. Be a panelist. If you have an opinion, if you want your voice heard, if you are a senior developer, a mentor, a mentee, if you are an aspiring developer, you want to be a developer, but you don't know what to do, we want to hear from you. I want to hear from you, and the audience wants to hear from you. So go to mentoringdevelopers.com/join and fill out a survey and let us know what you're interested in, what times are good for you, and so on. I'm looking forward to hearing from you, and I'll see you in the next episode.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.